when I went into this role, my first thought was, man, like, am I ready to be an agency guy? I'm just like a company man at a gigantic company. And my answer was, well, mostly no, but for this, definitely, because it satisfies my inherent curiosity for going into a brand new place and mucking around and seeing if we can make some meaningful change there.
Welcome to Wave Social Podcast, powered by Arcade Studios. My name's Mike. I'm here with my co-host Mitzi, and we've curated a show for digital marketers, advertisers, and modern entrepreneurs who want to stop chasing the tide and start making waves online.
Each episode, we'll sit down with the tastemakers and strategic minds behind some of the most engaged communities and up-and-coming brands. We'll pull back the curtain on their strategies and experiences to uncover the methodology behind their seismic impact. Thanks for joining us. Let's dive in. Welcome back to another episode of the Wave Social Podcast. Today on the show, we have Lars Bengtsson. He's the Chief Content Officer of Havas Health & You. He has built his career partnering with the world's most ambitious brands and creatives, and he gets into that in this interview. He joined Havas Health & You this year as a Chief Content Officer, helping a global health industry recognize and actualize their ability to create content that builds deeper and more meaningful connections with HCPs and patients. He also spent some time at Vice Media before that, and also at Thrive Global with Arianna Huffington, the one and only. And he's got lots of other amazing partnerships under his belts that he actually gets into in the interview. It's awesome.
Yeah, Lars actually worked with us on Some Good News last year as well.
That's right.
I call him the partnership architect.
He loved that.
Yeah, it tickled him in the episode for sure. A few topics that we cover in this one include how Lars positioned himself for his dream job with no experience or any real inside connections. It's a good story. We talk about creating reciprocal value and how that is what truly sets up great partnerships. Also, the concept of integrated marketing, which I found really interesting and completely different than what I expected his answer to be. And finally, the way to become a great leader is to become a better person, lead with passion, and take things less seriously.
And hire people you like.
Yes.
Which I really resonated
with.
You
do a good job of that.
Because we hire people we like to.
Definitely.
I also want to give him a shout out because he's our first guest to record with COVID.
Yeah, this man tested positive earlier this week. He still came through and did the interview. So all respect to our boy, Lars Bengtsson.
Yeah. We also want to talk about merch. I'm going to talk about my favorite product from this drop, which is the candle. We partnered with an amazing candle company called Mala the Brand. They have awesome candles. Been a big fan of her and her brand for a while. So I was really excited that we actually got to work with her to create a scent, a custom scent. And our candle this year is called OOO, which stands for out of office. So the scent is very like beachy, takes you away. It's meant to like feel relaxing and like you're at the beach. So I'm a huge fan. And hey, it lasts really, really long. The burn time, I don't know what it is exactly, but I've been impressed with how long it's lasted. So check it out.
Yeah. And when you run out, we got more.
That's right.
Before we get into it, I'm just going to read a review because we do that every single time. We got this one from Mr. Nathan R17. And he says, lovely podcast to learn from. I love this podcast. So good to hear from experts in marketing. It's great to hear from individuals who work in the marketing field and have experienced so much. I would definitely recommend. Thanks, Mr. Nathan.
Thank you so much. That's so nice.
So nice. But we're going to get into it because this interview is so nice too. So get ready for Lars Bengtsson. Lars, we're so excited to have you, man. This is one we've been waiting with lots of anticipation for. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so genuinely great to hear your voices.
Man, this is a catch-up, long time in the making. Mm-hmm. But to set it up for everybody, we always like to start with a good rewind and understand where it all began for you. So take us back. What's the best place to jump into your career story?
Probably right out of college. Because where I went to school, I was a business major. I wanted to study philosophy, but the conversation at the time was, you know, who would hire a philosophy major? Da, da, da. And so I went into the world getting two internships. I was so clueless. I went to internships.com. That's how little I knew about how the world worked, but that's where I got my first internship. It was at a financial PR company, a small boutique shop. I did my first internship there, and getting out of college, they offered me a job as a entry-level whippersnapper, not getting paid pretty much anything, but it was a gig. And so, yeah, I started my career in a financial PR company, which I did for about 2.5 years. And a year and a half in, I think when the shine of, oh, new job, new life, new everything kind of wore off, I woke up and thought, oh my God, I hate this. I hate it. And I was having these big existential crisis conversations with myself and thoughts and feelings. And at this time, I was like, what, 22, 23? But I was like, oh my God, I'm spending every day doing something I don't want to do. I ended up making my own life a living hell, just really existentially freaking out every time I walked into work. But first I wanted to say is, you know, the company, I was very fortunate to get into this job, even though it's not what I wanted to do. They were really lovely people. And I had a boss who was a phenomenal first mentor and now a current friend. But I quickly realized this was not the life for me. In fact, there was one person who absolutely loved this work. This dude was obsessed with financial PR. He was reading all the trades. He was coming into work whistling Dixie every time. I looked at him as this, you know, young kid, and I was like, oh shit, I'm actually really jealous of you. I want what you have. I don't want to be you, but I want to approach my work with this passion and this zest for life that you have. At the time, I followed the book, right? You pick a major and make sure that major is employable. And then you go find a job that can pay you something. And then you go do this and you keep your head down and yada, yada, yada. And I was never really introduced to this idea that you can align what you love to do with where you work right out of school or whenever you want, really. This was like a couple of years after the financial crisis. I graduated in 2011. So just this cultural temperament was, make sure you have a job. If you have a job, don't worry about it. No one was hiring 22-year-olds. No one gave a shit. Once I started shifting this kind of paradigm, I recognized I don't want to spend hours doing things I don't think are meaningful, at least to me at the time. So not really having any connections or even a sense of what I wanted to do, I just genuinely wrote down a list of things that I really enjoy. Music, technology, or travel, or exploration. And I started just mapping out companies against them. And then started a year and a half of just truly unsuccessful attempts at breaking into those industries. I still have emails I wrote to CEOs, to show creators that are so obnoxiously collegiate, just long and just verbose and flowery, that I was like, if I got this email today, I'd get the fuck out of here, kid. But I ended up just sort of relentlessly pursuing this idea that I could be in a place that would pay me money to do things that I think are interesting and flex my curiosity. And so it was just rejection after rejection after rejection, whether nothing or anything. Oh man, there was a time where I almost got I was so close to getting a job at Live Nation, where a few of my friends worked, and I love music and I wanted to be in the music industry so bad, and didn't get it. Broke my heart. A little time later, there was a company called Carrot Creative, an amazing digital agency. And I applied and I loved their application process because they were so digital. They were creating web tools with creative, you know, Montessori style games for your application. Like you have to like arrange words on a digital fridge magnet. And I was like, this is great. I can get stoned for this and maybe this will really shine. And that didn't work. But then after a bunch of unsuccessful outreaches at Vice, a company where I would pass through every day around my neighborhood where I lived in Williamsburg, I just kept thinking like, that's going to be the spot. And I tried unsuccessfully to break into so many roles on, you know, open roles. And finally, I looked at some of the senior leadership on LinkedIn, and one of these guys by the name of Hosty Simon, amazing dude, was the general manager. And I saw that we had a mutual friend in common on LinkedIn. So I reached out to him and I said, hey, my friend blank told us to get in touch. And he's like, oh, who's your friend? And I said the name and he was like, you can go kick rocks, kid. But he responded back to me with email HR, and he gave me the email address of the HR person's name. And that was all I needed, because that's perfect. And so I emailed the HR person saying, hi, Hosty Simon the general manager of Vice told me to reach out.
Let's go.
Inquiring about this job.
That's so cool.
And it was really shiesty. But 2 days later, I had an interview with someone, a good friend by the name of Kim Purse, for a project manager role. And I did some real sleuthing. I looked her up on Facebook. I realized we liked the same music. And I just thought, okay, it's on. I'm going to make sure I incorporate music into this conversation. Kim knows the story too. This won't be a big reveal. But then we got together at the office. I was in the Vice Media office. I had cracked through. This was 2013. So this is when Vice was a big fancy schmancy name. We'd just come off the HBO investment. It was all you know, daisies. And so we had an amazing interview. And at the end of it, she's like, so what else about you? And I said, well, I love music. She's like, no way. Who's your favorite band? I said, well, I love Interpol. She's like, no way. Me too. I was like, get out of here.
And what are the odds?
And so she's like, I want you to come back in tomorrow and meet Hosie Simon. I'm like, oh, great. Awesome. The next day I come back in and he's late and he comes in and goes, oh, you're the kid who lied about our mutual friend. And I said, yes, I'm sorry about that. And he goes, no, that was actually pretty good. It's resourceful. And he goes, I'm sorry. I have some really shitty back problems that have been acting up. And I have had a shitty sacrum my entire life, of which I'm just starting to deal with now. But that was all I needed to bond. I was like, no way. I have a bad back too. We started talking about yoga. He referred to me to his chiropractor. It was all great. And we were talking and vibing. And he said, well, I don't want you for this job. And I said, oh. And he said, well, because I have another job for you. That's not in existence yet, but I think it'd be really good for you. And I said, yay. And he goes, yeah, we want to start this as soon as possible. You know, next week. Let's go. Oh my God. Yes. 100%. I don't hear from them for 3 months. Like just total silence.
Whoa.
Just nothing. I just got ghosted at the highest point. I was like, oh, I finally sent him a note, literally saying something to the effect of like, I thought what we had was special after he just didn't respond for like 10 times. But he got back to me after that saying, sorry, on hold, like we'll hit you up. And there was, you know, months went past, more unsuccessful interviews, more just kind of losing grip on any sort of hope, just being sad and angsty as a 22-year-old that has way too little perspective on the world. But I remember packing the car up for a long weekend trip. I had taken off work and I had everything ready to go. And I just flicked my email once when I was in the garage before leaving. And at this time, I was on Long Island. I'd lived in the city. So I drove back that morning and I flicked the email. And it, you know, months later, it came back and said, hey, we are ready for you again. Would you be ready for a meeting in like 2 hours? And I said, yeah, I guess. So I drove the opposite direction back to the city, had this meeting, got absolutely grilled by my two bosses, Tom Punch and Ben Dietz, who are both incredible. Then I had just got kind of spit out. And I said, okay, I hope that went well. But long story short to all of that, they brought me in a few weeks later and had a few more Q&A. And then I started as the creative development coordinator at Vice. One thing I remember from that is my first interview, I was in a suit and tie at my, you know, in the financial district of Manhattan. And I made sure to leave early so I could go back home, change out of my suit and tie and into normal people clothes before this interview, because I just thought, you know, if I showed up with a suit and tie at Vice in 2013, they'd have thought I lost the plot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I had just kind of sniffed this opportunity and tried to use everything in my power to make it happen. And I got my shot, which was really nice.
Yeah. And it happened. That's amazing.
I'm just curious, like, as you recount that story, if you encountered a 22-year-old kid today who was kind of wrestling with his career options the way you were, would you give him the same advice of what you did? Like, write down all the things you're interested in and, you know, find companies that embody those interests and go for it? I feel like you were so relentless, but it sounded like you had such a clear vision of wanting to be there.
Yeah, I had the clearest blurry vision of all time. I knew that I wanted to go in a certain direction, or I knew I wanted to structure my life in a certain way and spend, you know, if you spend the majority of your waking hours working, for me, it was you better enjoy what you do. Otherwise, it's going to be a rough go at it. If they're as clueless as I was, I would certainly say start from the basics, start with what makes you happy. But now it is a tremendously different landscape for a 22-year-old. First of all, you're Gen Z, you're in demand. You know, millennials didn't get into demand until later on in my career. But you're in demand. You also have more tools at your disposal to stand out or reach out or research, which can be overwhelming. So I think starting with the absolute basics is a great first step. But there's more ways to outreach and there's more ways to be creatively approachable than ever before. So I would just, at this point, it'd be based on what are they most comfortable with. Some people are just like cold calling relentless badasses, and some people are more pensive and really let their energy and their presence speak, but they're not necessarily as good as being so front-facing. But there are so many great ways to reach out, and there's so many great ways to try to find a connection. I would hopefully just, if I did my job right, help them identify what works for them.
Yeah, and some people are even like applying for jobs on TikTok.
Oh yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, it's amazing. Why wouldn't you? I remember when one of our creatives at Vice put his resume up on Instagram when it was the hottest thing, like before TikTok, and I was like, that's fucking genius. It's good for them. Keep innovating.
Yeah.
You started as creative development coordinator. I'd love to hear a little bit about what that looked like. Like, what was your job description? And did you have that moment when you started of like, yeah, this checks the boxes of those things that I wrote down? Or did it take a while to fulfill that?
What I wanted to do at the time, or what I said I wanted to do at the time, was like work in a cool place. I was very driven, you know, like a lot of younger 22-year-olds that don't really know who they are or have a sense of themselves yet, they want to show the world and therefore basically show that they matter. So I was looking at cool, posh, sexy campaigns that Vice was doing and their edgy tone and the success that was coming to them. And I thought, I just want to be a part of that. I bet I could learn a shit ton because goddamn, like everything here is cool. Everything they're putting out is cool. So at the time, you know, when I had talked to Tom and Ben, who were my drill sergeant interviewers and then my bosses and now great mentors, they were describing the genesis of this role and why it was needed. And it was around the time where digital content, like online content, branded content, whatever you want to call it, was really fresh and new and on the come up. And it was right around the time you read all those articles about Art, Vice, and BuzzFeed, the new Time Warner. And we were saying, hell fucking yeah, we were. Absolutely we are. Because that's, you know, use the momentum and the advertisers flock that way. There's a big media existential kerfuffle about where the world's going. And Vice, who bet early on digital video in 2007 when they made Vice TV, when Spike Jonze was the creative director, they were one of the first people to put the digital documentaries up on YouTube and everything else. And so they had a really great head up and leg up on the competition, both existing for a while and upcoming, because they've made those investments, they made the mistakes. And now at a time where the attention culturally is turned onto digital video and ways for brands to engage, especially with that young audience, they were getting a lot more attention. And so they went from selling magazine ads and everything to selling sponsorships. And now with the 1 year advent of the branded creative team, before it was just whoever was working there was the creative, the seller, and everything else, which was an amazing lesson. With the advent of the creative team, they were fanning out the type of things they could sell and how they could really monetize and exploit the Vice IP in different ways. So the creative development coordinator was basically someone to catch the fastballs being lobbed in every direction from sales, creative, strategy, media planning, design, blah, 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 and lob them appropriately at the right cadence and the right speeds. So the coordinator was basically like, hey, make sure everything kind of flows through, especially in the pre-sale phase. The post-sale phase is not your worry. Don't worry about it. We're going to get it from there. But the time from when an RFP comes in or when we have an opportunity to present to or pitching to how we win, that was basically my remit at the ground level. And clairvoyantly was a incredible, incredible proving ground for the rest of my career.
It's awesome. And you started as the creative development coordinator, but your last role there was publisher, which is quite a come up. How did you do that?
It goes back to that really relentless pursuit of actualization and trying to find meaning. So once I was in there, I was like, I'm in here. I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know any of this world. I just came from financial PR. I finagled my conversations and my interviews to make it seem like I knew everything, and I didn't. I had like a fight or flight response to learn or to sink or swim or whatever the axiom is. And so I just reached out to every single department and the heads of it, the middle, and I just like, what's wrong? What's right? What's working? What's the most frustrating part about your gig? And I tried to be the sieve for all those holes. At the time, I think Vice was only about 150 people in, at least in New York, 120 people in New York. There was a really close relationship between everybody there. And as a result, once you, you know, I learned this early, you know, once you prove you're effective, you're going to get used and used and used. And it was totally symbiotic for a long time because it's like, yes, 100%. I have no problem staying till 11. I have no problem sleeping in the office. I didn't care. And because of that, I just got a bunch of opportunities and a bunch of exposure. I had a lot of smart people that were very happy to have a young whippersnapper to do the work for them, write their notes and everything. So when you don't have that many people and everybody's so busy doing things, you can make suggestions based on the observations that you see that could maybe improve things. And they say, yeah, fucking go for it. I don't care. Please just get out of my face, make it better or don't make it better. There was no like big approval processes, at least at that time. It was just go do it. If it works, it works. There, I got opportunities to hire someone. And all of a sudden, I was thinking about working with all the different channel leads at, you know, Vice and Munchies and Noisy and the Creators Project and all what have you. And thinking about building decks of these ideas that kept swirling around in different pitches, but didn't actually sell. So these great ideas were just sitting on the shelf. And that's a problem I think every single company faces. And I said, let's make a book out of it. You know, so we started doing franchise decks, and that incorporated a lot into the way we package the products and the projects. So throughout this time, over this course of the 6 years, I just gradually learned from the best content creators in the world how to tell a good story, and the best marketers, I think, in the world about how to meaningfully add value to your audience's lives and convincing those clients that adding that value does lead to sustained trust, which does lead to all the ROI objectives you're after.
Those are some big topics.
Yeah.
You mentioned how to tell a good story. Is there a way to distill that in a couple points for our listeners so that we can benefit from those crazy smart people at Vice in that time?
Absolutely. I mean, it ties into exactly what we all did at Some Good News. And I think a huge part of their success was not hiring traditional filmmakers and traditional producers and people. They were just people with their ear to the scene that were naturally artistic types that had an ear for really good stories. The same type of shit that you would love to regale friends with over the bar or anything like that. These were folks that had access to a lot of really wild parts of life and were really happy filming it. And the best part about this kind of amateur filming style is they turned the camera on and just didn't say anything, didn't really direct or do anything because they didn't know really what to do. So the result of it is this really great first person raw, as if you were filming it or there yourself, view at a really interesting subject. And over time, as Vice got better and better of what it already did well, it began really partnering with the platforms to create endemic stories that fit on those channels, something that we all do today. But it was pretty new at the time. And one of the lessons I would say is, as we proliferated the platforms we told the stories on, as much as possible, we never let the format dictate the story. We let the story dictate the format. And that was tangible in times where we would shoot, you know, the editorial team would shoot something made originally for Instagram, right? But then as the story was unfolding, we thought, shit, this is way better told long form. We should tell this on YouTube. And I've seen that for projects too, for brands, and like that flexibility, not necessarily being afraid to rustle feathers after a signed agreement with the client to say, hey, as we're shooting this for you, we're recognizing that it'd actually be a lot more organic and therefore more effective to do it this way. And more often than not, when we really were set in that intent and really saw something there and you stuck to your gut, there would be a better product. Another is, from a story perspective, most of your effort is in pre-production. Most of your effort is finding that story. Most of your effort is figuring out someone or something that is inherently interesting that's not been looked at in a traditional way and figuring out what to do with it.
I think that's really key because, especially in social, I feel like often it's like shoot now, think later. But I love the idea, especially when you're thinking about creating a more interesting, dynamic, engaging story, of like really just taking the time to put in the thought ahead of time, mm-hmm. so that there's less that you have to do in post to really bring it to life. And it's really just the finishing touches. That's really good. I think it's safe to say that everyone knows who Arianna Huffington is. And we want to know what it was like working for her. But first, we really want to kind of map out this transition from Vice to Thrive for you, because they're two distinctly different platforms and like environments and types of companies. After tenure at Vice, What led you to make that transition, and what was exciting or magnetic about that opportunity for you?
I think what would be more interesting is how I made the decision to leave, because the Thrive situation came rather normally in the grand scheme of how opportunities in my life have popped up. But quickly going across Vice from, you know, a creative development coordinator to starting the integrated marketing team and running that function where I really was sitting on the fence at the intersection of the creative side of the business and the business side of the business, and then using that platform to launch the Viceland TV channel and create new models for television advertising that take cues from our digital roots, to launching broadly with a brand like Unilever, to launching the very, very interesting and chock full of lessons joint venture of Live Nation TV. Oh, fun fact about all that. At the end of my cycle back to the beginning at the financial PR days, when Vice hired me, we did a deal with Live Nation that I ran the development for, Live Nation TV, the one company I wanted to. And that later that year, we acquired Carrot Creative. So it all works out.
Yeah, there you go. You still got a chance to work with them.
Exactly.
In a better capacity, probably.
In a better capacity with longtime friends I still have to this day. But throughout those 6 years that were, you know, if I could sum them up in three words, it would be formative, outrageous, and absurd. I was given so much opportunity. We were given so much opportunity that no one in the right conventional mind would ever give to a group of kids, ever. We were making wild decisions. People just a few years older than me were commanding deal sizes and thinking of new ways of advertising and communicating with an audience that have never been done before. And it never felt that outrageous at the time because no one was telling us no. And that was a really amazing and fertile ground that I feel very fortunate to have grown up in, to really shoot as far up as possible. I was driven so deeply by this sense that I need to make a little bit more money, that I need to get this next title, this and that. It was terribly unhealthy, but I'm thankful for it and grateful for it because it propelled me face first into a lot of lessons and a lot of good things that I've now combined to shape this version of my life that I'm quite happy in. But when I became publisher, which was about a year and a half before, I was at this point, five something years later, I was disenfranchised a bit. I had bigger aspirations than the opportunities were presenting to me. The publisher role was a agreement that I'd stay in some more and use the platform to be able to go see what's out there in the world. And yet a year and a half after that, I get a call from some recruiter. I never thought I would be, you know, a recruiter, because most of the time no one ever knew what I did outside of Vice. So there was a head of branded content role at Thrive Global, which is Ariane Huffington's company. And I ended up meeting Ariana, and like a 15-minute conversation turned into, you know, an hour plus pillow talk. It was great. We really vibed. And
pillow talk, how fitting for her because of her commitment to sleep.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, exactly. She's got me in the subconscious. No matter what, she really is the sleep queen. But she gave me an offer on the spot. And a few weeks later, I felt, okay, let's go do this. It was actually kind of scary, not necessarily the new opportunity way or leaving after so many years way, but I was still kind of wed to this idea that you should be in a cool company, you know, to myself. And I look at Thrive and I was like, this is okay, but it's not cool, man.
Yeah, it's not like the music and the like stuff that you mentioned that you loved.
Exactly. But I thought to myself, you know what? Wait a second. This is kind of what you've been looking for. You want to make something. You don't want to go to an existing cool place. You want to go make something cool. You want to go take the bones of something that has a lot of promise and enhance it and bring out its truest self. And that is the opportunity that I was able to afford with Thrive, which was a really interesting chapter.
Yeah, it's so cool. So before we dive into some of the stuff at Thrive and what you're doing now, can you just give us like a brand partnerships 101? Like for anyone who's listening, we got lots of like marketers, maybe people who are early in their careers. Can you give us like a quick summary of what you think a brand partnership looks like now? Doesn't have to be digital, but what you're doing specifically with brand partnerships, and then what are the benefits?
I think a good brand partnership involves that reciprocal exchange of value that I was talking about. And I think the benefit of a brand partnership is obviously increased proximity to the audience you're talking to, or maybe an audience you want to talk to is kept under a certain person or a certain company or organization that you might not have access to unless otherwise partnered with. But regardless, you know, when I think about Spotify's relationship with their users, I think of that as a perfect reciprocal exchange of value. I am more than happy to not only give you a few bucks a month, but to give you my basic data and what I listen to. Go ahead and take it, because what you're doing with it is turning it into a consistent stream of new music that I haven't heard of. Spotify has become a deep part of my life and a part of, you know, millions of other lives. Their algorithmic features are unbelievable. They've invested in their audience. They've invested in the musical growth of their audience. They've invested in expanding horizons and have also found ways to break into new areas as a result. A lot of the partnerships that they've done with brands or with other organizations are so, or even with people, are so endemic to what that audience is looking for. I would just say, as you know, for any brand partnership, just think like, are we doing this to appease the client? Are we doing this to feel cool about ourselves? If so, that's fine. But where is the underlying purpose? Why are you partnering? Why do you want to go partner with this person? Why do you want to partner with this influencer? The death knell of so many campaigns and so much ROI lost, as you guys well know, is the siren song of trying to partner with a massive influencer with a bunch of followers that doesn't have anything to do with the brand. So it's about being able to make it work for both sides. One great example from the Vice days was on a routine Vice Sports visit from Carmelo Anthony. We were doing some sort of a Vice Sports feature with him. The publisher at the time, a really great man, spoke with Carmelo. And Carmelo was just talking with him about how obnoxious it is that in the locker rooms, they just corner him with a bunch of microphones and talk about his performance or talk about the injuries or talk about the team's performance. And he's like, they have no idea that I'm in Cuba building basketball courts for kids. And you have no idea about the programs that I have around the world. They have no idea what's going on in this part of my life that I'm passionate about. And so Vice created a partnership with Carmelo Anthony and created a subsection of Vice Sports called the Clubhouse, which gave us access to Carmelo Anthony and his incredible mind and his incredible following, and gave Carmelo something to talk about or a microphone in which to talk through. And so that there also became a very attractive sponsorable opportunity in which brands were very, very happy to come in and be adjacent to and within the conversation of this really cool moment in culture. That never leaves me, because it was such a perfect example of value exchange. And we really started with the purpose behind all of it. What's that going to do for the audience? Is this going to add to their experience? And absolutely, yes. We're the only ones who were able to actually dive into the mind of this brilliant star and with beautiful attention to detail, tell the stories that he's been wanting to tell.
One thing I wanted to talk about is your bio for Can, which is like a cool flex, first off. But it talked about building the integrated marketing function at Vice, and even more specifically, quote, connecting big brands with big ideas. And that sounds cool. So I wanted to just get a little bit more info about that and talk about what that looked like practically.
Integrated marketing, the way we defined it at Vice and the way it eventually turned into an industry term, is just the amalgamation of sort of the technological aspects of our business and the human put together in service of the audience. So the world of creative advertising has so much money in it and so much technology promising to hyper target the most specific reaches of the subconscious and zap it into doing whatever you want it to do. But where has that left us really? When it works well, as specifically intended, it turns us all into two-dimensional tunnel vision consumer zombies. And when it doesn't work well, the message is just ignored. As is the case with most things, the truth is somewhere in the middle. So integrated marketing at its core is creating things to say that match where the audience is in their life and not being limited by platform or passion point in order to do that. You know, all of the ad targeting in the world isn't necessarily bad, but it's severely limited in the absence of a human input. The way I described it is a practice that requires the marketer to shed their work identity as creative or sales guy or strategist, etc., and instead adopt a little bit of everything in order to paint a complete picture of who you're trying to talk to, so then you can engage with them in ways that inherently interest them with as little friction as possible. So, you know, connecting big ideas to big brands, those big ideas are only big when they work. So the opportunity of integrated marketing is to be able to actually do away with everything we've learned in terms of exactly how to target a specific person and being able to set your dollars and your ad spend to that and expect the same return every time. It is the inherent quest to understand who your audience is, how they're evolving, what scares them, what gets them excited, where do they go, and being able to create experiences without ego or without a direct white knuckle grip on your message to be able to translate the message wherever is best for them.
That's so different than what I expected your answer to be, but I'm like super into it. What you're kind of describing is just like as creators or marketers or advertisers, like tapping into our human intuition more mm-hmm. than just like having the tunnel vision of our creative function.
Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting.
Everyone feels it, right? Like you feel on the projects that you work on, the every now and then, the thing you get to make with this amazing team that really makes an impact, search your brain and chances are there was some level of passion involved across everyone on that team that transcended the indexes or the insights or any sort of rules you had to create. I mean, we know this very specifically, being able to create some good news. We eschewed pretty much every single rule, and it I don't think is a coincidence that we got the output and the response that we did. John Krasinski was a really great magnet, but I think the reason the show truly took off is we did take a form of integrated entertainment and integrated marketing, and we were really egoless with where it showed up and how it was received. The only North Star that we experienced time and time again, we went up against this with John and with each other, is does this fit for the audience? Does this make their lives easier?
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you brought up some good news, because as you were explaining like your approach to integrated marketing, I could practically see how that was executed with your role with Some Good News and producing the show. Can you give our listeners a bit of an overview of what you were doing specifically on that project?
Sure. I would say, in addition to you guys being sort of co-creators and co-builders of the overall program and the architecture and what it is, I ran all of the partnerships, you know, both brand and platform across the 8 weeks we did it.
You're connecting big brands with big ideas.
Brands with big ideas. And we had this, it was like free play for 2 months, because very rarely do we get an opportunity where something is funded by the creator. So it is no longer beholden to agencies, to companies, to all the hand-wringing and the handshakes and the egos and everything else, but it was just this group of us, and it inherently had a direct impact on the way we approached partnerships for Some Good News.
So I just want to be able to like celebrate a little bit about Some Good News. We've talked about it on the show before. We had Weiss on here last season, had an absolute blast with him. But Lars, man, talk to us about where you were when you got pulled into this opportunity and what you felt and what that moment meant for you, and not just your career, but also in the heat of the pandemic and all of that.
Oh man, I love taking trips down memory lane with you guys, because it's just any excuse I can to talk to you guys in person is amazing. I was in Montauk riding out the beginnings of what was supposed to be a 2 week little passing cold in March 2020. I had actually just negotiated an exit with Thrive for the end of March, taking a new job at Havas Health & You at the beginning of April. And then the pandemic hit, and Havas and I delayed the partnership for a few months to figure out just what's going on. So for the first time in my career, I had left the working world without a parachute. And I was really kind of excited, because I've had this latent idea in the back of my head for years to actually stick my fingers in different pies and work on different creative projects in a consulting capacity and just satisfy my fast twitch urge to work on everything. And it was a really good push out of the nest to be able to do that. So towards the end of March, I was like, oh boy, I should probably call some people. 2 weeks later, I was approached by our good friend, Mike Germano, and asked if I had some time to meet that one guy from The Office who's had this idea to start this show about good news. And I said, bring it on. I'm not doing anything. And a day later or so, I was chatting with you guys, and here we are. But yeah, Some Good News was a dream experiment with ideal conditions, really. It was one that I think every creative person or curious person who is tired of the morass and on the corporate side that gets in the way of getting good ideas done would love a shot at. Because it wasn't just what we did. Your users know and your listeners know very well how much of a rocket ship this thing became in such a short time. But it was how we did it that was really the most impressive part to me. You know, millions and millions watch the show, but most don't know that it was actually just 10 of us breaking all the rules in the A-list production playbook. No agencies, no companies, just us working together in a completely egoless and single-minded fashion to, I think, during that time now in retrospect, keep ourselves sane. And we did it by using our time to try to bring as much joy to other people as possible, which I can't think of a better way to spend some time.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it was truthfully for me, like the best distraction, the one that I needed most. And I just got to get sucked into this spiral that touched so many people's lives and also kind of kept me in this groove of good news and helped us all stay positive at a really crazy, scary time.
Yeah, there was something about seeing and mining the social sphere for good news stories every single day consistently that really trained your brain to think of the positive, right? I think it had a profound impact on all of us during that time.
Absolutely. And I don't want to brush over the fact that we also raised a lot of money for charity. I know we've talked about integrated marketing already and getting back to the human side of things, but on top of making everyone feel good, we also got to raise a lot of money. And a lot of that was from some great partners that you were kind of spearheading. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, Mike reached out to me because, you know, his specific words or his, you know, his loose words were, John needs somebody to handle the partnerships and I don't want to give it to people that are going to screw it up, which was a nice little vote of confidence. But
that sounds like Mike.
Yeah, it does sound like Mike. It was really amazing because John, not really knowing any of us beyond the screen or on some phone calls, picked up on what we were good at and really let us run with it and let us know almost every time, like, I'm not the person who's good at this stuff. You're good at this stuff. But John, who self-funded this, allowed us to create rules of engagement that didn't sacrifice our brand integrity or our mission integrity. Even the greatest partnerships will take a few shots at trying to get a little bit more than what is their fair share in service of getting their message out there. And almost every single time, the kowtowing to that by companies, by agencies, etc., will lead to a worse product. And John was incredible in being able to reinforce time and time again the solid mission of being able to spread as much joy to others. And he had this great internal compass for understanding or almost clairvoyantly looking into the future and saying, if we do it this way, if we do the way this brand's asking for, we're not going to deliver as good of an experience. So we played around with this great model when I was putting together what a package could look like for, you know, a variety of sponsors. And, you know, around this time, there were brands around the corner, out the door, waiting to work with us, you know, but everybody was looking for their moment, their integration into the show that could be basically paid for by a big sponsorship fee or something. And the remarkable thing that we did was we said, don't pay us a dollar in sponsorship fee. We're not trying to profit a buck off of you. The cost of entry is going to be a giving moment that is dependent on what we believe the right act would be for our episode that fits and is congruent with the theme of the episode. And the trade-off there for being able to basically scrounge your senior team up and get all the approvals ready for a you know, 7+ figure, whether direct cash or in equivalent value donation or giving moment, to get all that together within a short week window was a level of earned media and credibility that you'd have never experienced during that time. You know, a couple of the brands that we worked with, we had responses back afterwards to them saying that their PR from that and just the natural earned press from that got them more mentions than the Super Bowl.
Crazy.
Let's go.
Like, come awesome. On. Like, you're planning for the Super Bowl year round. People get hired and fired over that in the tens of thousands around the industry. we were able to take a few iPhone cameras, a pretty magnetic personality, but more importantly, a really strong creative intent and a really strong platform and two-way communication system via the social team, kudos to you guys, and turn it into these massive ecosystems of engagement around every single episode. And brands that were brave enough to step into the unknown with us in service of making people happy, they were rewarded. So, you know, we had Pepsi donate $2.5 million. Why that number? Because the episode around helping and supporting chefs was built around Guy Fieri and his restaurant employee relief fund, which was at 17.5. And we said, I bet 2.5 would make it a really nice even 20. And that would be pretty great. PepsiCo had already given $1.5 million. They were willing to give $2.5 million more because they trusted us in the fact that that would be the right thing to do. And of course, they were like, what if we gave a little bit less? And we'd be like, nope, can't even be 19,999,099. And be able to say that to a brand was crazy. But the brands that were brave enough, like PepsiCo, like AT&T and Starbucks and FedEx, they got these incredibly organic moments that actually put their money where their mouth was and showed the world what they were about. And we were able to bring it to life creatively in a way that was actually heartwarming. And so the exchange was so great. And one of the best was talking to all the brand teams that worked on those deals with us, from AT&T to Pepsi to Starbucks to FedEx, were so overjoyed. I still have those emails saved. They're just so happy to be able to contribute. That's kind of what we were all excited about during that time, right? Like during a pandemic, the ability to align what we're doing with doing well and doing things that we know how to do that positively affected so many people during a time of intense anxiety and sadness is the most life-affirming thing you could spend your time with.
100%. So you mentioned that these brands really celebrated the results afterwards, and they could obviously see the value then. But earlier in the conversation, you talked about strong, healthy partnerships are the result of creating reciprocal value. So I'm just kind of curious from your perspective, because you were like this partnership architect, how did you effectively communicate that reciprocal value before they experienced it? Because you mentioned how it was so different than what they're used to. You know, they're used to just being able to pay a sponsorship fee for a moment and approach it that way. And it's about them. But then you manage somehow to change it to be more like a giving moment, like you said, where they're just donating to charity and we're kind of deciding what that number is. And we're like suggesting what that good feeling will be afterwards. But how did you communicate that before the moment actually happened?
Well, partnership architect makes me sound way cooler than I am. I'll never be an actual architect. So I think partnership architect.
Use that on your next can bio. I got you.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's a great question. It was really interesting because we had this ocean of brands looking for partnerships, but most of them was basically the equivalent of like, Subway wants to do the Subway happiness minute break. And, you know, no offense to Subway, didn't reach out to us. So sorry for being mean to them. But when we outlined very quickly what our rules of engagement were to exchange a giving value for organic entertainment placement, that pool shrank to a pond. But still, there was a pond of really big brands that were interested but had a lot more questions. So the ability to like field those, to have conversations with those, to weed out the right ones and be able to deliver a major moment within literally 4 or 5 days required an approach to how we package this opportunity that made us able to spread it out as fast and wide as possible. And so one thing that you guys helped me so much on was making this not about the integration moment in the show, which was, you know, that golden ring that everybody wanted. You know, how are we going to be integrated in the show? And our answer to that was organically by John, and he's going to write it himself and we're going to work on it together. And they always said, well, can we play with that? Can we see what they're saying? Can we adjust what he's saying? He said, no, it's going to sacrifice the integrity of the show, but it'd be wise for you to think of this as a partnership within the entire Some Good News universe and ecosystem. We have millions and millions of engaged fans across every platform that you could think of. We had a store which all the proceeds of that merch that was all fan created, taking our, you know, rewarding fan art with opportunities to actually put it on and buy merch, in which all proceeds go to the charity of your choice. We had back in, you know, behind the scenes videos, we had this whole ecosystem of content that was able to be messed with and played around with. And so the way we packaged it was, you know, having this moment in the show be just the beginning of something that is going to pulse out consistently throughout the week. And that required a great deal of effort between you guys and coordination between you guys, between, you know, Amelia and the Made In team, and how we optimized the video. And what we ended up doing was creating these packages out of thin air that all of a sudden started to get really attractive to brands. Now you're not just getting the integration and show moment, but you're getting a separate piece afterwards. You're getting a whole fan component. You're getting engagement two-way back and forth. One of my favorite examples, and just bringing up the PepsiCo example again with the Restaurant Employee Relief Fund, when John's daughters made the Pepsi logo in a show of thanks that John held up on a sign, Pepsi turned those with our partnership on our store, turned that logo, that hand-drawn logo, into merchandise that sold on our site, with all the profits going to increasingly to the Restaurant Employee Relief Fund. And we raised something like $17,000 more. It was amazing. Out of nowhere. Just because we had this idea and we thought that people would reward the brand act of Pepsi by contributing in their own way. That's one of my favorite bedtime shirts, by the way.
Yeah, that was so fun. And as we talk about it, it always brings up such good memories. And honestly, we could talk about SGN for a long, long time. But we also want to get into what you're doing right now, which is also really exciting and equally worth talking about. You're the Chief Content Officer at Havas Health & You. And we're big fans of Havas. But could you tell us a little bit about this company, what is the purpose, and what your role is there?
Totally. Yeah, Havas Health & You is a health advertising communications network within Havas. It's actually the third business unit in the Havas sphere. There's Havas Creative, which many people know. There's Havas Media, which many people worked with. And there's Havas Health & You, which is this behemoth that exists almost outside of the creative and media eye, because healthcare to date has been this bit more enigmatic and, frankly, probably a lot more boring to the folks that would be interested in Havas Media and Havas Creative world. But that's starting to shift. And that shift is exactly why I'm getting really excited about it. But I met the Havas Health folks in Cannes in 2019 when I was at Thrive with Arianna Huffington. And we started immediately getting on from, you know, the CEO to the CMO on down. And we worked together to think about how we could leverage, you know, Thrive IP and some of the, you know, the Havas Health brands, and start thinking about more of an education, entertainment, bigger space. And those conversations ebbed and flowed. But, you know, we stayed in touch. And like I said, the Chief Content Officer role, which is a very strange and, you know, foreign role, foreign sounding title in general, but especially in the healthcare world, started with a conversation with Donna, the CEO, and Megan, the CMO, around January of 2020. And those conversations were just around this changing of the healthcare guard that was coming in. And, you know, little did we know how much more it would be exacerbated with COVID and everything else. But culturally and commercially, the healthcare world is in a huge state of flux. It is now the most, obviously, the most important category in our lives, no matter who or where we are. COVID has made sure of that. But more so, the health landscape is kind of the last unturned stone of creativity and genuine audience engagement of all the, you know, of every industry. You know, CPGs and telco and consumer facing, and even, you know, B2B have been already on the board of deeper audience engagement, really understanding the audience where they are, being able to broaden out their creativity and their advertising and start to actually use their communications as forces for good and giving back to audiences' lives. The healthcare world hasn't really needed to do that until now. So the conversations that were cool and heady and philosophical around that with them, and it kind of parlayed into this: what if there was a role across the Havas Health & You network, which, you know, under that comprises of, you know, over 20 agencies, that evangelized content in the best ways that it's been created, you know, across the best brands, across creators, individual publishers, etc. And what does it look like to integrate some meaningful storytelling into the world of healthcare? That became really interesting. So that was supposed to be the role in March, and then it got delayed because of COVID. But then, you know, we re-engaged again around June, and I worked with them sort of on a ramp up capacity until I started in January. But yeah, the role is open and broad by design, because this world of healthcare has a lot of work to do in service of operating with a broader and more intimate understanding of its audience, of doctors and patients, of, you know, of HCPs, patients, not treating them like a collection of symptoms or one who writes prescriptions for A, B, or C, but looking at them from the whole human being perspective as people who naturally evolve and shift and change and have a lot to say, have a lot they've been asking for already, you know, in the airwaves that we haven't been listening to, and have a lot to offer and are asking for the right brands to connect with them on the right, you know, in the right way. These, in every company in the healthcare space are genuinely at their core healers. My hope is to evangelize content as a form of healing beyond the product area, because as we well know, the best way to build a relationship with a person, if you're an individual, is not have every action or transaction between you guys be a sales transaction. You're not trying to sell them something. If every time I reached out to you guys, I was trying to pitch you my multi-level marketing scheme, you probably would talk to me a bit less. But we get together and we share ideas and we communicate and we grow together. And that is what I think these brands have an opportunity to do, that have, that holds so much data, that holds so much information on conditions, that have the ability to challenge so many cultural and social stigmas that have not in the past, because there hasn't been a real financial interest to do that, as bad as that sounds. They have, why innovate when your patents run for years and years and years? And why innovate when, after getting through all the hoops of the FDA, you're able to just sort of coast because people need your stuff? Well, the reality is people are just tuning out. There are way more opportunities for healing than ever before. There's way more options. And a lot of the fear around today has kept people in their social stigmas and dug in even more. So to me, it's an opportunity to sink or swim for the new generation of healthcare communication.
Absolutely.
Love it.
I can see why this role would have been enticing to you from that first philosophical conversation with the CEO and the CMO, but also now to how content actually translates into making change in the healthcare space. That's a huge undertaking.
And in people's lives, like, yeah, health impacts people's lives.
Absolutely. On that note, have there been any like phase one or like pet projects or like early wins that you've experienced in the first little while in this role that you'd be excited to talk about? Or what have you experienced so far compared to why you jumped into this in the first place?
The biggest difference between my previous roles at Vice and Thrive and Some Good News and doing some consulting and starting some different projects, and this one, is time and the rate of success. You know, I was raised in fast twitch companies, immediate successes companies, things where every week mattered. And that was amazing for a while as like a, you know, growing up as like a high chaser, just trying to figure out how I stand out and just giving opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. But then, it very quickly burns you out. When I went into this role, my first thought was, man, like, am I ready to be, an agency guy? I'm just like a company man at a gigantic company. And my answer was, well, mostly no, but for this, definitely, because it satisfies my inherent curiosity for going into a brand new place and mucking around and seeing if we can make some meaningful change there. And the relationship I have with Donna and the rest of the leadership team there, they're nothing but encouraging of this explorative approach that I'm taking to this. Because to be able to get an entire industry that's never really thought about it this way to expand their definition of advertising beyond an ad lob and some tactical placements to thinking from an integrated perspective and thinking about content as a way to heal past traumas or to connect deeper with someone takes a long time. The one thing I hear all the time is creativity is so limited in healthcare because of all the rules and regulations. And I kind of think that's been an excuse the industry has been using for a long time. There's certainly some truth to it, but if you can chart the expanse of creativity on a 1-foot ruler, they probably have a little over 6-7 inches to play in, depending on when, you know, how much work they do, even despite all the regulations, but how much work they do in understanding the audience. But I think a lot of folks play in the first couple inches and use this looming threat of brand safety and risk aversion and everything to not go there. And so I was really drawn to Havas because they're willing to take some at-bats for some of the riskier things, but the things that inherently move the whole landscape forward. And I needed that to be able, you know, I needed that permission from them to be able to do it the way we wanted to do it. Because this whole being in this world, and, you know, forget, you know, the company, for being in this world in general, isn't fun without being able to challenge a convention, being able to have the permission to go in and see if we can make something better for the sake of it and willingly put ourselves into uncomfortable spaces. Just like when I first started Advice, understanding what the hell I'm even talking about. So, like I said, there's over 20 different agencies that all serve different clients, both on, you know, the HCP business is different than the patient business. It's completely different teams. And really understand the terminology, understand what every agency was really focusing on, understand where they were in the process. Are they new vanguard modern thinkers? Are they old school till I die? Because they've, you know, they've it's worked so well for them in the past. And I've found this like really rich tapestry of everything from encouraging things to discouraging things. And I'm still to this day learning the landscape. But I really do think that starting with the what and the why, have the perspective of you know, the student mentality all the time, no matter where you are and what level you are, is a great way to start any job, because it opportunities reward the curious. And I've been able to see things that folks that have been there for years haven't seen and are now using to improve their communication and their content. And I've also been taught so by every one of those guys 10 times over. From a personal level, it's a really fascinating way to spend time. And I really like the opportunity to go up into the faces of some of these partners and these clients that have wanted to change. You know, when you listen to the people that are working on these brands, the majority of them, they want to do the things that we're talking about. They're dying to do it, but they're so scared of their boss, of the legal side, of this, of that. And as a result, the healthcare world has fostered a culture of risk aversion and creative suppression. I feel that because the folks in those teams, they want to make things so badly. They want to be remembered for things that challenge the convention of their company. So the way I see it, we as, you know, the Content Assembly is the team that I've begun, which is a cross-network team that helps every agency, helps our own production processes, etc. But I've tried to be as much inspirers and educators, because I think it is incumbent on all of us to our clients to be able to paint the picture of a future where content is at the center of everything they're doing. And what that goes into, or what goes into that, and the principles behind good content creation before we can start adding these things to what they do. And that corner cutting is what most of the advertising world does. And time again, we get crap returns on a lot of money because we haven't trusted the process. We haven't been excited or invested in the process.
I hear that. I want to talk about the Content Assembly, because that sets up perfectly where I wanted to go next anyway, which is the fact that at both Vice and Thrive, your work all connected back to marketing, but there was obviously a people component as well. And now we see that at Havas Health and you with what you just described, not just the Content Assembly, but unifying things across the Havas Health and you network of agencies and teams. And I want to kind of flip that a little bit to talk more internally. We've talked a lot about external communications and clients and healthcare systems and patients and all that stuff. But obviously, there's a level of building teams and unifying them here on the inside as well. So does that come naturally to you? Is that something that you've had to learn over time through your other roles? Or like, what part does that play in what you're doing as a chief content officer?
It's always come naturally to me, but I was really rough around the edges and just doing it, being managed, being a manager, asking questions, facing challenges, and really understanding what it's like to manage a person helped me not evolve my position, but come more into my own as who I am, which inherently helps me attract better people and select on a more specific criteria that is way more human than resume. I say, work on yourself. You're going to have a better team for it. Hire people that are smarter than you in key areas. And, you know, that goes back to that first point, because there are times, you know, more common than you think, where you hire someone smarter than you in a key area, and all of a sudden you have this ego dilemma because they're saying things in that you should know. And why don't I know this stuff? And, you know, being able to work on yourself and broaden your sense of self and step more into who you are allows you to quiet that ego. And I think that has a direct impact on how you hire people. Another thing is just hire people you like. You know, getting a good sense of yourself, you know who you like and you don't like. I'm so blessed to have an amazing team, and I love these guys. I don't treat them like, you know, there's no hierarchical structure. I see it as I am in a position where I can help them grow. They're in a position where they can help really manifest and prove out the theories that I've created for this team. And they're in positions where they get to go and spread the gospel in their own way. I don't really need that recognition. What I'd like to do is put the set pieces together and let each person, each individual, do what makes them so brilliant. I'm always fascinated by folks that are so bound to these rigid structures written in leadership books or seminars or everything else. I've been so repulsed by that in my, you know, personally. I think being able to work on who you are allows you to lead with passion. And when you lead with passion, you're going to attract the right folks. And leading with passion, as an asterisk, you know, without taking it all so seriously, people get heated in their work. Have passion and do it with honesty and openness, but don't, for God's sakes, don't take it all so seriously.
Yeah, that's good advice. I think every leader can benefit from that for sure, and just look inward first before they go outward, because that's what makes good leaders. So we're closing out this end of our interview here, but before we let you go, we want to ask you this question that we ask all of our guests. In your opinion, who's making waves right now and why?
More so than any brand, there's a lot of great brands doing great things right now, but what rings truest to me is the creators of the world. From the proverbial you is making the biggest waves. We've now, everyone's talking about the creator economy. If Ryan Mack was a guest, and I believe he was, he'll probably talk about that too, with where he is at Maiden. But there's never been a better opportunity in the world to share your story. There have never been more platforms that allow you to do that. And culture is taking note of that and seizing it. And we're constantly struck with, well, mostly filler and stuff that makes us question humanity. But at its best, people from all over the place that are genuinely using their voices and using their storytelling power, regardless of format, to change lives. We saw that firsthand at Some Good News. Our entire show is built on that. I was talking to a healthcare brand, and I showed them a video on TikTok during the heart of the pandemic of some hot Indian dude by the name of Forkhands, who was describing the mRNA vaccine to people through a character called Forkhands. And it did more numbers and showed more people a simpler but no less true version of the science than almost any of the brands during that same time. One single video. That, to me, shows the sheer power of those who make waves today. That's the power of the creator. And it goes back to what I said before, is understand yourself. There's never been a better time to be you, because chances are, in this big, wide world that we live in, something you put out that's true in your authentic voice is going to reach someone the same way. So kudos and hats off to the creators. I'm fully on board with folks using platforms to amplify their voice and manifest their creative vision without the use of major ad dollars. I think those dollars follow when that influence follows. But more importantly, those that can change lives with a single story. It's something that's still continuing to this day, thankfully managed by you guys from the Some Good News social platforms, just my favorite account to follow. Because every time I see it, I see something else that's going to make me smile and make me believe in humanity a little bit more. And there's no entity on earth able to do that more than an individual with a story to tell.
Love it.
Thanks for that back scratch at the end there. I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course.
No, but we're with you. I think first comes trust, then comes influence. Then at that point, ad dollars make a difference. But thanks, man. Before we let you go, we just want to make sure we let our listeners know how they can connect with you outside of this.
Yeah, sure. It makes me very happy in life to be able to field questions from folks looking for support or insight or any sort of guidance on anything I talked about. Because like I said, in the beginning of the podcast, I was that, you know, fledgling as well. And I really believe in paying it forward. So reach out to me on LinkedIn or hit me up on Instagram. I'm insta_lans, L-A-N-S. But reach out to me in any way you want to get in touch with me, larsbankson@gmail.com. I'm interested. I'll never say no to a good question. And I trust my intuition and I like talking with random strangers. I guess that's the crux of it.
This episode of Wave Social Podcast is powered by Arcade Studios. Show notes for this episode and other episodes can be found at wavesocialpodcast.com. You can also subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you've got questions, comments, or suggestions for future shows, hit us up at Wave Social on Instagram. Thanks for joining us.